Well, good afternoon to most of our attendees. Good morning for some. It's a real pleasure to welcome you to this Region 1 Regional Disaster Health Response System webinar. My name is Paul Bittinger. I'm an emergency physician in Boston. I'm the principal investigator and medical director for the ASPR-funded Region 1 Regional Disaster Health Response System. Clearly, this is a time of extraordinary strain and stress for healthcare systems, for coalitions, for states. Probably none of us thought 1 or even 2 years ago that we'd be in the position we're in right now. But with overall demand on healthcare capacity being what it is, significant staffing constraints, and unfortunately rising COVID numbers, we once again find ourselves as a healthcare system in the position of extraordinary demand on our healthcare resources. So I can't tell you how grateful we are for the contributions of James Hodge and Erica White, who will be joining us for this webinar, Navigating Legalities in Crisis Standards of Care. I will introduce Professor Hodge and then briefly pause for some remarks from Gary Kleinman, who is the regional administrator for the New England region, ASPR Region 1. But briefly, let me just say that James Hodge is the director of the Network for Public Health Law's Western Regional Office, and he is the Peter Kiewit Foundation Professor of Law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, as well as the director for the Center for Public Health Law and Policy at Arizona State University. Professor Hodge is a national and international expert on emergency legal preparedness, obesity laws and policies, as well as vaccination laws and public health information privacy. We've been extraordinarily fortunate to work with Professor Hodge for the last 2 years through our RDHRS program, and he's been helping us discuss and try to address legal and regulatory challenges that we face among the healthcare system coalition and state partners trying to prepare for response. So we're really, really grateful for him, for his colleague, Erica White, whom he'll address, introduce momentarily. But let me pause and introduce Mr. Gary Kleinman, who, as I mentioned, is the regional administrator here for ASPR Region 1.
Thanks so much, Paul, and thanks all of you. So amidst the abrupt rise of COVID-19 hospitalizations that we are tracking across hospital referral regions, or HRRs, in New England, the ASPR Region 1 team is incredibly grateful to Region 1 RDHRS and Professor Hodge and to all of you for this particularly timely discussion of legal issues related to altered standards of care and capacity management. In collaboration with FEMA Region 1 and a dedicated analyst team of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, ASPR Region 1 produces a weekly COVID-19 situational awareness brief, which last week highlighted significant 7-day increases in COVID-19 disease. Across our 6-state region, we noted an increase of 71% in cases and 29% in deaths. Of particular concern, there was a 22% increase in hospitalizations, which ranged from a growth in the Burlington, Vermont HRR of 8.4% to a rise of over 44% in the Providence, Rhode Island HRR. This week, all but one of the HRRs had further increases in utilization, and the Region 1 average of 3.66 admissions per 100,000 people per day is a growth of 0.57 from last week, gaining ground on the increasing national average, now at 3.79 per 100K. We issue a new essay brief every Wednesday, and we would be happy to add you to the distribution if any of you would like to start receiving it. We also recognize that the required hospital staffed bed and admission data don't take account of the actual burden on hospital operations that are incurred by ED borders, delayed transports, and specialty beds that are simply not usable for COVID-19 or general care. And the joint ASPR FEMA Army Corps of Engineers team is working with Region 1A RDHRS on a methodology to help characterize a more helpful picture of what Paul has called hospital operational capacity. I'll close by expressing ASPR's interest in working with state agency, healthcare coalitions, and hospital partners to support some type of coordination for capacity management that might include load balancing and resource sharing. With our compact geography, established healthcare referral patterns, and a strong history of cross-border cooperation and mutual aid since colonial times, New England's healthcare and public health sector seems optimally positioned to lead the way for new ideas and approaches. We look forward to Professor Hodge's presentation and the discussion, and welcome your ideas about ways that ASPR and our federal partners may be of assistance. Thanks, Paul. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Gary. And that, you know, it sets the stage perfectly well. I certainly wish this talk were not as timely as it is, but we're extraordinarily grateful. And so, James, let me turn it over to you and to Erica.
Paul, thank you so much. Thanks to all of our colleagues at ASPR for all their incredible support throughout every part of this pandemic and all of the knowledge and guidance we've received at the federal level within our RDHRS state. Special thanks to all of you all representing various different state agencies, state healthcare entities, and others. We hope today's session's really going to deliver on some of the really core, critical legal issues and other fronts that you're addressing. And to that end, we're looking forward to a great session. I'll give you a little bit of guidance about how we'll take questions and comments towards the end. First, if I may, let me introduce very briefly, because you'll hear from her shortly, my great colleague, Erica White, an attorney with us in our Western Region Office of the Network for Public Health Law and a research scholar at our ASU Law Center for Public Health Law and Policy. I'm so delighted that Erica can join us today. She's got specialized knowledge on particular issues in regards to RDHRS states she'll be sharing, as well as some updates on the COVID pandemic as well. Erica, so glad you can join us.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to a great session today.
Wonderful. Me too. Without further ado, let me, if I may, give you a good sense of some of where our material comes from. We've got some excellent material for you already up on the RDHRS Region 1 website in regards to what we call our legal resource guide. Now, this document will spell out some of the things that I'll be briefly covering, and Erica and I will just sort of glimpse over or sort of glean over briefly today, but to be sure, it's available to you at any point in time on the website. And all of the slides that you're seeing as well, we'll be making fully available to you if you would find them advantageous also. Okay, a couple of ground rules as we start. Let's, first of all, look forward to as many comments as we can get across in brief order that Erica and I will try to be as just as succinct on as we can, because we recognize the urgency of what we're all facing in regards to crisis standard of care. We recognize you may have questions and comments you want to address with us, and by that means, feel free to do so in two specific ways. At any point in time, if you would, using the chat function on Zoom, chat a question in. We're monitoring for those. We will only take them at the end, but let's say we hit a slide and you have a question related to it, chat that question right away so it's on our sort of agenda. We'll be looking towards those at the end of the session. We may even be able, with a little bit of help from our RDHRS coordinator, Meredith, to open a line or two to be able to hear from you directly. But to be sure, chat those questions. All right. Here's our game plan. It's going to be aggressive, it's going to move quickly, and it's going to do so because we've got a lot of great information we'd like to cover. And again, we look forward to those questions and comments. Let's talk about, very briefly, crisis standard of care and concept and practice. Why? Let's set the stage for what we're actually trying to pull off in real time during the throes of this emergency. So I'll give you a full sense of what we meant by this conceptually about 10 years ago through the Institute of Medicine when I was on the committee actually crafting what we see in crisis standard of care. How's it working in practice? What facets are there? Oh, we'll be delving into that for the remainder of our session. Erica will take us into a brief glimpse on sort of crisis standard of care issues on trial during the throes of COVID-19-related pandemic. Obviously, game changer as far as what we're seeing in real time for the last 2 years. What we've got ahead could be some of the worst we'll see, as of course, in 2022. I will then walk us through critical core components of what will kind of address as major legal challenges and potential solutions. We'll talk about legal triggers, issues around regional coordination, discriminatory impacts, and how we resolve those tie-breaking decisions. So, legally problematic. Give you a good sense of how to think them through. And a great topic that Paul and I have discussed, Eric and I have been working towards and thinking a lot about, crisis standard of care post-COVID. Oh, we'll see that day someday. But will we be beyond crisis standard of care? Probably not. As a result, I'll give you some thinking and some ideas to work through on those specific fronts. All right, without further ado, let's jump right into it. This was the H1N1 pandemic, which was the catalyst for crisis standard of care all along. And what we did through the Institute of Medicine in 2009 was conceptualize crisis standard of care from the sort of more amorphous altered standards of care approach. And you'll get my working definition of that from the committee in just a moment. Many of you all have found, hopefully, our subsequent 2012 toolkit that we developed as potentially helpful guide for any state trying to actually implement and think through crisis standard of care systematically as a great tool. What were these specific initiatives about through the national academies, or formerly known as Institute of Medicine. It's about shortages. It's about how shortages of space and staff and stuff dictate what and how we can respond in real-time events. Now, the H1N1 pandemic was a glancing blow, as we all know. Multiple other events over the last 10 years, Ebola-related scares, issues related to Zika virus and other specific fronts, glancing blows compared to the COVID pandemic. But to be sure, we've learned a lot in real time. For example, we've learned about what really is at stake when you're implementing crisis standard of care. This is how we defined it at the top of the screen through the Institute of Medicine and the National Academies. It's that substantial change in usual healthcare operations and the level of care that's due to a pervasive or catastrophic disaster. This is no one-time shift at the emergency room. This is substantial changes dictating very distinct healthcare operations due to a pervasive or catastrophic disaster. Yeah, it's COVID-19 for sure. But what you're really seeing is that sort of weighting or balance. What and how I like to legally think it through is it's when those sort of patient and population demands that we see, when they completely outweigh what's available in ICU beds or PPE or available healthcare workers or meds or capacities. So at the bottom of your screen, that sort of pocket definition that I consistently rely upon when you sort of know you're in a CSC is when sustained scarcities warrant real-time resource allocations to protect the public's health. That's the shift that's occurring. That's the nature of what we built the foundation upon in relation to crisis standard of care back in 2009. I might highlight and note in this sort of foundational illustration, many of you all have seen in our various different reports, two bedrock principles, ethical considerations drive a lot of what we do, as do legal authority and consistency around legal environment. To that end, there are a plethora of legal issues at any point in time available to us in that sort of toolbox mentality, available to us to effectuate crisis standard of care. Oh, we've got emergency declarations that have been issued, executive orders. We can waive statutory and regulatory provisions at the gubernatorial or presidential level, as you've seen President Biden and President Trump do. We've got licensure reciprocity provisions, scope of practice expansion, expedited procurements. We can take things as we need. We can reimburse in real time. You see all of these at work. They're all in our legal resource guide. But I tell you, the factor that always comes down to play is the one critical issue of liability. Who's liable under what circumstances for implementing care that looks, feels, and is different from how you implement routine healthcare services? Nobody wants to get caught in what I call that sort of web of liability risks. Nobody, no doctor, no nurse, no healthcare entity, no hospital, nobody wants to get caught in this because you know what we're doing in crisis standard of care is iffy. It's outside the norm, and it actually can look and feel to patients and their families as if something's been done wrong because it didn't reflect what they thought was necessary or possible in real-time events. How you think that through on a liability front gets us into a wealth of different observations, but I'll tell you one thing. When you shift from conventional to contingency, like that sort of bad night at the ER, to crisis standards of care, sustained scarcities leading to the need to shift to that sort of different norm of how you provide healthcare services in real-time events, hey, you have two paths you could follow in regards to resolving any potential liability claims that can arise. The path one is basically just say, follow the evolving standard and we'll apply whatever the standard is if that specific claim hits a medical practitioner or hospital at that point in time. Path two suggests we provide enhanced liability protections for healthcare workers and entities. Path two says, as pursuant to this final illustration on this point, there's an actual umbrella of liability coverage that's available during these types of events. When you're in the throes of crisis standard of care, if you can find a legal pathway, as you see under this umbrella, for how you might be protected from ordinary claims and negligence, that's golden because it means you can do what you need to do and not have the specter or fear of liability hanging over you, literally stopping your authority, what you might be able to do in real time. There are so many different avenues played out within that. We can go into great detail on that later if you'd like for questions and comments. But without further ado, let's shift our gears now and think a little bit more about just exactly what we're seeing in relation to crisis standard of care on trial. And that starts, first of all, with a glimpse of COVID-19 and its impacts to that. Erica, let me turn over to you.
Thank you so much. So first, let's take a look at where we are today. These numbers you see on the screen are from this morning. We just hit a huge milestone that we did not want this holiday season, 800,000 deaths in the United States. And look at these percentages. Although the U.S. is 4% of the global population, we're representing almost 20% of reported cases and 15% of deaths. Next slide, please. But we've been doing everything that we can to respond to this pandemic. So here you can see a few examples of federal emergency powers. These various declarations are the vehicles by which critical resources reach the states. All of these declarations you see here were put into place by former President Trump last spring in the earliest days of the pandemic. And all of these declarations have continued to stay under President Biden. These exercises of federal emergency powers are still in place today. Next slide. So to turn from the federal side to the state emergency response, you can see here on the screen that all 50 states and DC declared some form of emergency in response to the COVID pandemic. The specific names and corresponding powers of these declarations vary by state. In all these declarations, state and federal make a difference, as we shall see for crisis standards of care. Next slide, please. And against the backdrop of these federal and state emergency powers, a minority of states have been engaging in what we call COVID legal denialism. So here are a few examples of what these states have in their denialism playbooks. 25 states, including a number in the New England region, have rescinded their declarations, saying that they are no longer needed at this point. Relatedly, a number of states have chosen to reopen recklessly, focusing on bolstering their economy rather on preserving human lives. Other states have opposed social distancing from the very start of the pandemic, and other states, both by executive orders and legislatively, have banned mask mandates, they've banned schools and businesses from closing, they prohibited vaccine mandates, and efforts to check individuals' vaccination status. Next slide. In compounding these legal denialism actions, we also see varying vaccination rates across the country. Luckily, the New England region has some of the highest vaccination rates, whereas other areas, such as the Southeast, and the yellow there, have much lower rates. But in the Northeast, in the New England region, we have very high rates. Next slide. So keeping in mind the map we just saw, this map on the screen is from September, so it's a historical representation of ICU bed capacity, but everything that we're seeing right now is indicating that the problem is getting worse. These red dots, these hubs, are places where hospitals are at capacity. They don't have the resources that they need, they don't have the staff that they need, and this is a huge problem, especially where we don't have people getting vaccinated at the rates that we want. Next slide, please. And this problem of lacking ICU capacity is compounded by what you see again here on the screen. We're in the midst of an uptake in COVID infections. Is this due in part to the new Omicron variant? Perhaps, but we've also seen the legal COVID denialism and the lacking vaccination rates are probably coming into play here as well. So now I'm going to pass it back to Jane to learn more about the legal issues around crisis standards of care.
Erica, thank you. So is it any wonder that we're actually in the throes of having to implement crisis standard of care in repeated settings, in repeated states, against the backdrop of multiple waves and multiple ICU bed exigencies and all of these particular factors? No, this is what we anticipated in regards to what could be a sensational pandemic that COVID-19 has proven to be. In 2022, because of Omicron and other factors, maybe just as dynamic as we try to work through some of these critical issues. We've looked at, over the course of this pandemic, a lot of critical factors about what underlies success or failure in regards to crisis standard of care. And implementing it in various different settings and specific realms has led to a host of different really core legal observations, as you're seeing on screen. And we're going to walk through these very briefly just to try to give you a sense of some of those major challenges and help you think through how to resolve them. Issues related to legal triggers. When do you know you're in crisis standard of care? What's the legal trigger that tells you? So much confusion over that. Nationally, we're going to dispel a lot of that right here today. Issues related to regional coordination. Oh, we know the need to do it, especially in our New England states. It's so critical and so essential. And maybe in New England states, we're doing it better than other parts of the country. But legally, what are the hindrances or how do we get around some of those factors? Issues of discrimination. HHS, through the Office for Civil Rights, multiple other state and federal entities have pointed out discriminatory impacts that are not intended. Nobody wants these impacts, but they're happening, and how you actually resolve those and avoid potential legal tripping points, critical as well. I don't think there's more dynamic factor or issue than what you'll see when you put the spotlight on crisis standard of care because of issue number 4. It's time to break ties. when you're involved in having to break ties between patients who have equal interest in a specific limited resource, like a ventilator, like access to an ICU bed, tough decisions are made, legal tripping points arise. We'll walk you through some of those. And then this great topic we're going to actually talk through for the first time in any national webinar related to post-COVID crisis standard of care issues. Let's think that through and see how much we can get done on those fronts. All right, let's jump right into it. First of all, legal triggers. The thing that we said all along when I was on the IOM committee establishing and conceptualizing crisis standard of care is you'll know you're in crisis standard of care because there will be specific sort of legal triggers like emergency declarations at the state or local level, at the federal level. And the reality is, though, the invocation of crisis standard of care as a direct component of that has only happened actually in five states. One of them is one of our New England states in New Hampshire, the first to do so, at least from our awareness of formally invoking crisis standard of care. Arizona followed suit in June 2020. We're still in it. We never abandoned it. Issues related to Idaho just recently this fall, issues in Alaska, New Mexico in December 2020, they invoked it again in October 2021. These are formal invocations. You know you're in crisis standard of care when you see states make these particular determinations, but the sheer reality is almost every other state has faced crisis standard of care in hospitals or other settings. But did they and how did they determine whether they were legally involved or whether they legally tripped that moment where they shifted into crisis standards? That equation becomes more problematic. And we've been working to resolve some of that, as you'll see in just a second. But to be sure, let's always remember the formula which always works. If you have sustained scarcity of resources plus patient surges during the throes of emergency, you're in crisis standard. The question is, do you have supporting legal triggers to make that a reality? Beyond what you see in regards to emergency declarations, Eric and I have been looking in conjunction with our great colleague Jen Pyatt at other types of legal triggers. For example, what you're seeing on screen. Erica, you've been looking at some of our New England states especially. Tell us a little bit of what we see here.
Yeah, thank you. So here on the screen, we have a list of a few examples from the New England state crisis standard of care plans. So all plans, of course, first look to federal guidance, such as from HHS, CMS, or federal emergency guidance to trigger implementation of crisis standards of care. Another example of a trigger is emergency declarations, such as Maine's plan, which visualizes CSC activation following an emergency declaration from the governor, working with the health department commissioner. Similarly, other triggers include executive orders, such as Rhode Island's plan. Language in the CSC plans themselves may trigger activation as well. So New Hampshire's plan, for example, describes a holistic three-factor approach to evaluate what's happening in the state to know when to activate CSC. Regional agreements such as the Emergency Management Assistance Compact and its international counterpart, which includes Canada, can also help determine when to trigger CSC. And finally, individual healthcare facility experiences can help determine when to activate. For example, Connecticut's plan describes looking to what's going on at hospitals and other facilities to know when to activate CSC, such as lack of critical resources or other shortages. So I'm going to turn it back to James to look at a few menus of legal triggers and powers.
That's right, Erica. And what's really cool on screen that you're seeing is this sort of litany on the left of your screen of just exactly what could be your legal trigger for implementing crisis standard of care. If you felt it was all tied to emergency declaration, of course, that's problematic because a lot of states in the New England corridor aren't in a state of emergency at this point in time. But it doesn't mean you lack that legal authority to implement CSC. Now, as Erica was noting, let me show you what that can mean and just how valuable this observation is for the purposes of feeling more confident legally about whether and how you can actually implement CSC within a hospital or across a specific region. This menu actually shows you the distinction between a state emergency declaration, a regional agreement, we've used EMAC here for that purpose, and PREP Act at the federal level. Now, PREP Act's not a distinguishing act for the purposes of suggesting you know you're in crisis standard of care when we implement the PREP Act, but it, like EMAC and like state emergency declarations, offers a menu of legal options that are invoked by their implementation. What are we trying to show here? Hey, choose your legal trigger carefully for what and how to implement CSC, but recognize across all of those specific options, you're saying license reciprocity, statutory regulatory waivers, liability protections, all triggered by these specific initiatives. And other arenas offer other additional specific benefits like telehealth expansions, scope of practice expansions under what you see with state emergency declaration and PREP Act. PREP Act I like particularly because it offers that preemptive facet of potential conflicting state laws that might be interfering with crisis standard of care issues. Our whole gist of what you're seeing on screen is to suggest you've got a lot of options. Legally, be aware of them, and legally knowing with confidence that you've got specific backup on some of the things you may need to have set to implement CSC fully. Regional coordination has been a really critical factor all throughout this pandemic. And to be sure, the emergency declarations, CSC plans you see across all of our states, they differ a lot. Because as a result of those differences, you do see very critical observations that relate to state, private, tribal, local, or federal-related implementation issues. How we actually coordinate across all of these jurisdictions, very dependent upon a lot of these critical factors. There are so many solutions to improve various different regional coordination across states, within states. For example, surge lines have been used very effectively. For example, just here in our home state of Arizona, we've got a surge line that's been used really quite brilliantly for the purposes of allocating and moving patients systematically within our state alone and sometimes to other jurisdictions. Multiple of those sort of surge lines used in a lot of other states as well. Medical operation coordination cells, or MOCs, are being used very effectively in a host of other jurisdictions. Again, to make sure that you don't have to go into crisis standard because you're moving patients effectively and lawfully. CMS has got specific authority to pull some of that off through their own initiatives and reimbursement-related structures they put into place. FEMA as well. EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, sets out key parameters for what and how you'd actually have to typically screen or stabilize or transfer patients. Some of those measures were set aside temporarily by HHS during the course of the public health emergency. Not the transfer provisions, though. Those are still very much in place. And Congress is always working on new legislation actually to actually implement these specific sort of initiatives long-term, post-COVID as well. Some of those initiatives exceed what we can do today as far as explanation, but to be sure that they're under consideration on Capitol Hill as we speak. One of the things I think we've all seen constantly in response to crisis standard of care, in response to the entire pandemic, is the potential for disparate impacts in implementation. One headline after another, one article after another reporting something that we consistently see almost in every state and across all sorts of racial, ethnic, and other types of arenas, is this potential for disparate impacts. Now, these are all things we wish to avoid, but crisis standard of care makes this particularly hard, I think, because the spotlight's on. We're watching carefully how we actually distribute and allocate those resources. And in regards to a specific condition like COVID-19, the net effects of it become all the more real. How do we work to avoid discrimination in crisis standard of care? First of all, let's recognize what's legally not an option. Any categorical exclusions based on specific populations is off the table, cannot be used for the purposes of allocating based resources. Exclusions that are based on discriminatory impact or colorblind policies, also very problematic for those reasons. What you're after are yellow light initiatives, things that are diagnostic tools which you don't intend to be potentially disparate, but they're facially valid on the surface. Sometimes even those can result in discriminatory impacts. To that degree, fix them through green-lighted tools that anticipate discriminatory outcomes and adjust hard to avoid them, like you're seeing with social vulnerability indexes and otherwise uses of those indices in specific states, working effectively to make sure to spread those resources in crisis in a fair and equitable way. Those specific allocations make big differences. What you're seeing as well at the presidential level in regards to this recent task force reports is really clear recognition that if crisis standard of care has exposed that sort of unfortunate and disparate impact side of our healthcare distributions across the United States, we will work and to think about how to fix them long term. We can't resolve all disparate impacts in real time through crisis standard of care. That's tough. But what we can do, as recommended in this federal report, is to, first of all, convene a multidisciplinary panel to think this through and make those adjustments in CSC planning going forward, disseminate those standards widely, seek adherence to accreditation and reimbursement requirements, and even support research for better understanding how to actually implement and sort of intersect with those specific issues to avoid ageism and other particular fronts that are disproportionately impacting communities across the board. These are real guidance suggestions from the White House to be administered hopefully in the near future. Can we get through this pandemic sufficiently in relation to those specific initiatives? Just get some additional reasons why and how as we go forward. This specific issue that we turn to now and be as brief on as we can, because even though I think it's the most dynamic of issues, it's also one of the toughest to resolve. When you get to that point in implementing crisis standard of care, and you've legally gotten to that juncture where it's time to break ties, you've got patients on screen, all of which have some right or need or potential medical purpose in accessing that single ventilator. The question is, who gets it? Your goal, as you know, in CSC planning, is to avoid this day entirely, to the full degree you can. But almost every CSC plan that's worth its salt will get to that moment of at least suggesting, here's what and how to break those specific ties. The legal factors that are actually prohibited, either in federal law or in state laws in specific jurisdictions, not everyone, but in specific jurisdictions that we've monitored for and watched, the legal tripping points, the things you cannot use to break those ties, is what you're seeing on screen. Look at all these different things, everything from obvious factors like race, color, ethnicity, sex, gender, age. None of those have a very critical role to play in breaking these specific ties. What religion or conscious of exercise of conscience that comes into play, assumptions of perceived health status, disability-related issues, duration of need due to disability or age, all of these factors in some way, shape, or form are legally prohibited. Some triage committee members, some doctors at the bedside, some having to make these tough choices might wonder, what can we actually use to break ties? What's legally viable? Well, we actually took a look at what's being used in specific states in the our specific region. And Erica, you actually got a good chance to look through some of these CSC plans. What are those criteria that are actually out there embedded within the plans themselves?
Yeah, thank you. So you just showed us this long list of factors that we can't use in tie-breaking. And so here's what we're left with. These are a few examples, like you said, that are described in the New England region plans of criteria that we can consider in crisis standards of care decision-making. So some factors that we can consider are where patients are, where they're in their life cycle. Are they young, healthy patients? Are they likely to survive? Do they have favorable long-term results? We can also look to whether individual patients have terminal conditions or if they're pregnant. And we can also use scientific measures, those diagnostic tools that James was just speaking to, such as SOFA scores or other measures that determine survivability. Is the care or the resources going toward urgent or routine care? During the course of the pandemic, we saw many hospitals choose to suspend elective procedures to reserve some of those supplies. And finally, some plans prioritize treating individuals with crucial roles in crisis response. So now I'll turn it back to James to discuss these tie-breaking factors further.
Yeah, Erica, I mean, what you're seeing in all of our six states are these sort of criteria being utilized, and it's deliberative. It's actually well stated in many of these plans. We've got a table that shows some of the specific documentation we'll be happy to share. But you know what's also interesting? These criteria alone can also lead to some legal problems, like the use of SOFA scores, unqualified, absent further, those potentially discriminatory impacts. As a result, how do we suggest curbing or getting around these specific issues in these particular tie-breaking scenarios? Well, we suggest looking closely at these allocation bases. These are the things we think legally you can get away with in regards to resolving tiebreakers without tripping legal bans or legal barriers to the extent to which they can be used to resolve who gets what specific resource in a given pool. For example, resource limitations or suitability. If you have specific resources that are only suitable for certain populations, I mean, just the way they're made or the way they're implemented, of course you devote them to that population. But you use the best current public health information. You do individualized patient assessments, as the Office for Civil Rights highly recommends at HHS. Objective medical evidence. You use equitable clinical assessment scores, not raw scores. You tailor for them, as Massachusetts suggests doing in its own CSC plan. Short-term survival, use it. Long-term, don't. It's discriminatory. Age-related factors, if they're prognostic, can be used, but not as sheer criteria as a sort of exclusivity issue. And you've got other factors at work there too. Patient consent, healthcare worker status, like pursuant to reciprocity, issues related to appeals, always important to embed within CSC purposes. There'll be winners and losers on any given tie-breaking decision. The losers are right back in the pool for consideration the very next time those critical decisions are made. All of these factors align in relation to very tough legal challenges, and we hope you see now some solutions to those critical points. But there's your day coming. We hope it's soon. I think we all do nationally, but especially in the region, with so many critical points now facing so many hospitals within the RDHRS region, there will be a point someday when it's actually the balance being outweighed is not COVID patients, but non-COVID patients. Now, are we looking forward to that day in 2022? I say you bet we are, because it means we might have found that way either through new drugs, through Pfizer approved by FDA, or new vaccines that are working even better, or just Omicron not being the threat that we might have thought it was. Whenever and however we get to that day, to be sure, we face another crisis, quite potentially, when the patients who have waited extensively for healthcare services for months, being put off for elective procedures, non-elective procedures, tests, routine issues, things that we haven't been able to pull off in the healthcare system for months on end, when they start showing up in droves, will that not lead to its own sort of out-of-balance issue related to crisis standard of care? It's quite possible. That's exactly what New Mexico realized in October this year. You see, because it implemented crisis standard of care for a second time in New Mexico, a very low populated state compared to Arizona, for example, compared to Massachusetts. But what New Mexico actually issued in October 21 was a new CSC declaration or invocation, not so much based on influxes of major numbers of COVID patients, it's the non-COVID patients and their influx that was actually at the source of some of what you see in New Mexico's recent invocation in that respect. There are some very critical legal differences at play here. And to be sure, we're not going to be able to resolve all of these differences right here and now, but at least let me highlight one. There is a very big difference legally between the potential legal tripping points or problems and how you provide health care in major emergencies. It's substantial. You need to be very cautious and careful about adhering to crisis standard of care in the provision of those specific services. And providing you're meeting those particular standards, you should feel comfortable walking free or walking away from that without the specter of liability and all those issues. It's a different calculation when you have to omit care. And so you see what I'm after here. What I'm really suggesting is what you're going to actually face in relation to the sort of influx potentially of patients literally waiting on the sidelines for months on end is the need to actually omit care, to put them off further, to say to them, you'll have to get tested a month later than what we hoped. That new replacement for the knee or hip or what have you, it needs to wait. That cancer treatment, because we wanted to start it, we can't yet. The omission of care produces as many problems, or more so, than the provision, because the issues around that from a liability perspective are quite distinct and profound. Here's another factor at work, and this one's so tough. I often talk about what we're doing in real time in these emergency declarations. I like to call it legal triage because it's exactly what's happening. Doctors, you all are doing a great job triaging patients. Lawyers and policymakers, we're triaging legal and policy issues. And we're doing that in the backdrop of declared emergencies against knowing that we've changed that legal landscape, as Erica noted, and most importantly, we've got to rebuild some of those critical observations. Do you know what's interesting about post-COVID CSC? We got to reverse on this. And we have to reverse on it because, as noted in this specific slide with the circle around our New England states most especially, we're not in emergency any longer in multiple New England states, and a dozen or more others. That legally changes the landscape significantly. How you actually invoke crisis standard of care in real time when you're not in a state of emergency, oh, that makes a legal difference in so many critical different ways. So these four factors, I think, really come into play. Let's briefly touch base on them. We'll get right to your questions and comments as a nice thought. Go ahead, and any questions you've got, put them in the chat now, and we'll be turning over to Erica here in just a second to monitor a little bit for that. But let me explain these four really quick issues about resolving CSC legal challenges post-COVID. First of all, remember what Erica and I were talking to you about, the legal triggers. They're manifold. It's not just the emergency declaration. If that were true, you couldn't be in CSC in multiple New England states because you're not in a state of emergency any longer. But there are other triggers at play. Use those wisely to those effects to trigger the particular legal support you need to do CSC in real time. That's advantageous and I think quite dispositive in relation to that issue. Coordinating care across regions, the same tools like MOCs and surge lines and other specific fronts, the same authorities that we got pursuant to EMTALA waivers and other fronts, may not all be fully implemented systematically, but gosh, what we've learned during the course of that and how we've exchanged patients and personnel across and through EMAC in specific settings is remarkable. Take those critical lessons away from what we've done during the pandemic and continue to apply them across each jurisdiction or region, like the New England region, to coordinate care across. As a great colleague of mine, Umair Shaw, who's the health commissioner in Washington State, really highlights systematically, avoid CSC at all costs across your jurisdiction. Because the moment you get to CSC, you know you're in that status of actually potentially losing or having deleterious impacts on patients that was avoidable. If you coordinated care better, work to every angle to do it, the legal techniques are in place. Addressing discriminatory impacts in routine healthcare delivery, that's the big goal. That's the very driving objective of the Biden administration. It's a critical core part of the sort of post-COVID planning that's already in place. Congress is on this specific issue. States are looking at it carefully. Now, we've got factors like COVID denialism that Erica talked about so nicely earlier, but the sheer reality is we're going to have to address this specific issue straight up, and at least there's national impetus to do so. Why? COVID exposed it badly. We're addressing for it after the event. Yeah, we've got our work ahead. And finally, resolving tie-breaking decisions. Here's the hard part. Remember that slide I showed you that showed you those 12 patients? Now imagine the situation is not you got 12 COVID patients. You just got 12 patients with 12 different conditions, all of which need access to maybe that one resource, that ICU bed, or that specific cadre of medical professionals that are very good at addressing their issues. Which of those 12 patients with 12 dissimilar conditions actually gets in line for it? Hey, the COVID plans in place in many states, including New England states, will help address those specific issues. But the sheer reality is those are tough, difficult decisions. They're ethically problematic. They're medically going to get complicated. And to be sure, legally, even if you've got the impetus and authority to make them, they're going to be questioned. Be ready for significant changes in regards to tie-breaking issues. And remember Dr. Shaw's admonition all the way through, avoid CSC to the fullest degree you can. Because you don't have to make tie-breaking decisions if you don't find yourself in crisis. All right, without further ado, we've thrown a lot at you. Thank you so much for your patience and opportunity to address these specific issues. Now, we're turning it over to questions and comments. Here's what I think we'll do. I'll go ahead and take us off screen, and we'll go to stop sharing at this point in time. To the degree to which we can receive or hear from anybody directly, I will defer to Meredith Hutchison, who may be able to direct that, but we may see some questions in chat. I still highly recommend, if you would, place them in there, and we'll take them on in real order right up until about, say 5 minutes or so before the top of the hour. Erica, are you seeing any questions in chat so far that we should address? Otherwise, we'll turn over to Paul and Gary for potential early questions. Anything you're seeing so far?
Yeah, I have a couple things. So our first one, how do you respond to folks who argue that the standard of care should not change, that the standard of care is always what a reasonable provider would do under the circumstances? So why do we call this crisis standards of care instead of just crisis care?
Oh, it's a great question. Well, if I didn't explain that fully, let me try to do that right now, because that was at the heart of what we tried to conceptualize 10 years ago at the Institute of Medicine, and it pervades us today. Here's what's so different. Let me be really quite clear on this so we know, because I really love the question. Here's the critical distinction. When you shift into crisis standard of care, what's in your patient's best interest is no longer the predominant focus. A shift to crisis standard of care is a shift to population health-related needs. You've got to triage patients in real time. You've got to make tough decisions, but the patient's best interest is not the sole parameter or barometer for which you would actually make those tough choices. You're doing what doctors and triage committees have to do in real time. Make tough choices knowing they may impact certain patients negatively, but you're doing it to save the most lives possible in the shortest period of time. That's the critical difference. And yeah, you need that intentional shift into it. This is not about conventional to contingency care. Like I say, bad night at the ER, more patients than you typically have. That's contingency care. Do your best. Crisis standard of care shifts focus from an ethics and legal perspective. Erica, such a great question. So valuable to hopefully highlight and make that point quite clear. Erica, additional questions? Anything else showing up there you see?
Our next comment points out that some points on slide 35, which I believe were the list of factors that we are not considering, seem to conflict with the next slide that shows what some of the plans in the region do consider. Do you mind if I speak to this one, James, really quick?
Oh, yeah. It's happened in every state we've looked at. They all have embedded within their crisis standard of care plans, not for any egregious reason, not because they're trying to create discriminatory issues. They're trying to draw conclusions and tie-breaking scenarios on how they make those tough choices. And in doing so, notwithstanding great input from committees, they're tripping on legal barriers that have been identified by HHS, by specific states, within state courts, within other specific arenas, as the type that lead to discriminatory impacts. Nobody wants that outcome. Nobody intends for that outcome. But it happens. And against that backdrop, those do raise legal tripping points. Our suggestion to any state that sees that specifically when it's planned, and believe me, in almost every CSC plan, we see some sort of tie-breaking criteria that could be problematic, carefully assess it, look at it closely, and work to adjust for it. It's something you've seen HHS have to chastise some states for with its Office for Civil Rights. Don't get caught up in that machinery, because you really do want to have critical criteria set out that is at least discriminatory facially and in its impact. Great point, Erica, and great question from our audience there on that critical facet. We see it too. Erica, anything else you see?
Yeah, what about using vaccination status as a tiebreaker?
Oh, I've heard that one. Oh, the controversy. We all know what it is. To whatever degree our ICU beds are filled up across the New England region, we know it's with unvaccinated persons. Because it's happening in Arizona, it's happening in Texas, it's happening all across the United States. So do you flat out use it as a basis for saying, I'm really sorry, but we cannot give you that ICU bed because, you see, you could have avoided this day, quite honestly, literally, if you'd just been vaccinated. Everybody else that got vaccinated seems to be doing the breakthrough cases are highly minimal as compared to unvaccinated individuals. It raises profound issues, though. And even though I've seen some very high-level doctors and other personnel make strong arguments for using vaccination status as one criteria for resolving tiebreakers, I'll tell you, actually, it really gets harmful and damaging when you start to realize just how much that can have a discriminatory impact on persons, at least early on, that didn't have full access to vaccines. Now, I think the federal government's done a fantastic job of resolving that issue through the greatest national vaccine campaign ever in the history of the country. But the sheer reality is, as a distinct criteria, it trips potential discriminatory issues I don't think you want to absorb. Our healthcare services are built around trying to provide the best available care to the most number of patients, saving them notwithstanding whatever faults or harms they brought into the specific equation. If you use it as a sole criteria, you're going to trip them improper legal issues. If you use it as a criteria, you still might find it's unpalatable and very difficult to implement. It's such a great question, though, because it's showing up in a lot of jurisdictions considering it within triage committees. Great stuff, Erica. Any other questions that we're seeing?
Yes. If a state announces it's adopting crisis standards of care, what are the requirements for individual hospitals to adopt or abandon that request to implement CSC?
That's a nice point. I like it because you see what, you know, just extrapolate from what you've seen in Arizona. Even though it's our state here and we're broadcasting live from Phoenix, it's, I think, being replicated across multiple states. The state says shift to crisis standard of care, but that gives discretion to hospitals as to when to actually go forward and implement their hospital-specific plans. Now, that's a neat approach, and it gives discretion to those hospitals to do it. But does it allow a hospital that's sheer by its own sort of assessment facing crisis to still avoid it? To still almost say, I know we're filled up to capacity. I know our ER is totally full. We got no ICU beds, but we're just not going to shift to anything distinct. We're worried about the liability. We're worried about the impressions in the community. We're worried about the politics. We're worried that the governor doesn't like the shift, even though we've actually had to go that route in specific settings. The sheer reality is when you see your state health department or otherwise that's lawfully authorized to issue and invoke that crisis standard of care plan on a state basis, I think any healthcare entity is wise and smart on legal grounds to effectuate it when circumstances result in the dual capacities. Overwhelming number of patients, sheer lack of resources. Those two factors, that leads you into crisis, invoke it when you need to. I think that's wise and very critical to highlight in states that have invoked their plan formally. Erica, good stuff. Anything else?
Yeah, so in developing the CSC plans, how do we partner with the legal department at different facilities to identify the umbrella of legal protections that are available?
Well, first of all, I love it. Look to that legal resource guide where we explain a lot more of what fits under that umbrella. And if you want more information on that, gosh, Erica, you and I both know we can get a lot more data to any legal counsel in any specific department or hospital that asks us directly. And you, for sure, you know, you saw our email addresses and such on screen, but we'll be happy to make those available. Most importantly, though, this isn't rocket science. This is the definitive path for protecting healthcare workers, especially volunteers, and sometimes even the hospital entities or others or clinics that host them. This is what federal, state, and even sometimes local officials have put into place, definitive protections to insulate against ordinary acts or ordinary claims in negligence. Now, it doesn't insulate against criminal behavior, and if you get into gross negligence and do things that are malicious, nobody's going to insulate against that claim. But the sheer reality is acts of what otherwise might be viewed as ordinary negligence, gosh, the definitive policy objective has been protect those healthcare workers to the degree possible. Look for it, and we'll help you find it in any jurisdiction. Erica, such great questions. Anything else arising?
In states that have not adopted CSC or allocation of scarce resources plans, are there things providers can do to protect themselves if they need to go into CSC on an individual facility basis or regional basis?
Yeah. Wow. Such a nice point. I'm literally semi in shock nationally when I see a state that does not have a CSC plan. 10 years ago, through the Institute of Medicine, we highly recommend states look at that. CDC's put major funding into it. ASPR's put funding into it. They want states to have those plans, but not every state has gone that route. And when you haven't, and you're a healthcare enterprise within that specific jurisdiction that might lack that, oh, you know, through the Joint Commission or other specific arenas, you've been asked to set out those CSC plans within your host jurisdiction. Let's say, or host entity. Let's say you still don't have that in place, but you're facing what everybody would recognize is that typical deluge of patients and that short supply of resources or healthcare workers or otherwise. What you're really capable of doing at that point is not necessarily inventing it on the fly or triaging in real time, trying to make it up. Defer to what you're seeing works in other specific settings of like-minded or like-sized hospitals or other states, and utilize those to the fullest degree you can. You're insulating yourself against potential legal trouble and concern, but also it gives you a game plan that might just apply as routinely or as well to your hospital or other setting as you see in states around you. That would be the best suggestion I'd make. I'm still astounded that there's any particular entity that lacks that direct resource, but referring to what's around you can make a big difference on that end as well. Erica, great. What else?
Those are all our questions from the chat.
Fantastic. So without further ado, let me turn it back over to Paul and or Gary for any additional comments, questions, or thoughts. Thank you all so much for having us and the opportunity to explain these critical issues. We really appreciate it. And Paul, over to you.
Well, thank you so much to both of you. Obviously, just so grateful for the fantastic and thoughtful presentation of the discussion and for addressing all the questions that have come up. Obviously, it's just an extraordinary time with an extraordinary set of issues. And I think, you know, James, I don't know if you would disagree with me on this, but I don't think even in the early days of crisis standards of care discussions, people sort of envisioned it playing out the way that we've seen it in the last year or so.
So true, Paul. Couldn't agree more. I've talked to fellow committee members that sat with us together, you know, 10 years ago. We knew about pandemics. We actually talked about them in the plan. We just didn't realize fully how an entire nation could be directly impacted simultaneously. COVID's basically recalibrated everything we thought about in regards to CSC going forward.
Absolutely. But so grateful for all your work in the pioneering days as well as work today. Just that, you know, so extremely helpful to our region. So with thanks to you, thanks so much to Gary Kleinman and the ASPR Region 1 staff, as well as to our funders at ASPR. We hope this has been helpful to everyone who's participated today. A copy of the recording of today's webinar will be available on our website, which is rdhrs.org, within a day or two. It just takes us a little while to get it formatted, but we'll get it posted for you and your colleagues to take a look. So thank you again to everyone. I wish you the very safest of holiday seasons. Mask up, get your booster, and we look forward to seeing you in 2022.